All right, so thanks everyone for coming. My name is Jason Barris. I'm a Director of Product Management at Infragistics. We're a user interface experience design company that builds components that help developers and designers build better user experiences. So the user interface is sort of where that starts when it comes to software. And today we're going to be covering some of that process on how you can get there and learning about hopefully some new ideas that you can take with you to help you build out some better user experiences in your applications. So my email is jasonb@infragistics.com in case anyone wants it for later, has any questions, or wants to talk more about this stuff. So here's a little bit about what I do. I manage all the products at Infragistics as well as the evangelism group. I'm an MVP. I've been an MVP now for about 7 years. I've written a bunch of books. The latest book is Silverlight 3 by Rocks Press. I did a talk earlier on Silverlight. There's a lot of Silverlight talks here over the next few days. If you're interested in that technology, which sort of dovetails into building better user experiences, I would highly recommend that you check those talks out too, because that platform is a very emerging and very exciting for the types of applications you can build and how you can help your users have a better time maybe using the apps that traditionally maybe have been Battleship Gray, not very fun to use, and the platforms are getting more mature to help us get some better user experience there. So we're going to talk about today is understanding user experience. We'll talk about patterns for user experience, which is really the foundation of where we come from when we talk about the UI, is UI patterns and how they can fit into your applications. Some of the platform issues, the problems that these patterns will solve, and then I have some examples of some good user experience and some bad user experience. These are things that probably a lot of us experience every day, but it helps us sort of solidify what we should be working on harder when we're building out applications ourselves. So I think that it's easy to say that user experience is everything when it comes to building an application or starting a business or doing a magazine ad or doing anything. It's the touch point that the consumer or the user has with whatever you're doing. So there's a bunch of words listed on here like reusability, availability, adaptability, scalability, reliability, all that stuff. And that's important because after someone's done using whatever it is that you are selling or building, they're going to say something about it, either good or bad, tell their friends about it, or decide not to use it again. It's very common, more common in the web area, where you go to a website, and I know I do this, if it doesn't come up in an adequate amount of time, I just close the window. If it looks like I don't trust it, I don't buy from there, I don't continue to browse. So there's a lot of reasons where you want a good user experience besides all the other back-end stuff. And a lot of that starts with the user interface. So when we talk about applications, the user interface is that first touch point where people start to explore and discover whatever it is that you have to offer. So making sure that that's a good experience is your primary job, really. So in the context of this talk, we're going to say user experience is about making great software. But you'll notice here in this example of the door, on the actual door rails, it says push. And on the doors themselves, it says pull. And we run into this all the time. And this is a real picture. This isn't made up. You run into this all the time in life and in software where things just don't make sense. And the reason they don't make sense isn't because they haven't been done before. It's because people aren't recognizing that there are known ways and known patterns of doing things, and they're not looking at those first. They're just doing whatever they think is right. And that's normally where we immediately break down is, if we think it's the right thing to do, 9 times out of 10, it's the wrong thing to do. Because we're not the ones who actually use the software. We're the ones building the software. Your teams and yourself sit in rooms and make decisions on behalf of ultimately the user, and that's not always the best thing to do. So in the context of software, of this talk, user experience is really about making great software for people. And that's what we have to realize is that ultimately, someone who isn't like you, who isn't a hardcore developer or hardcore into technology, uses the stuff that you build. So you can't make decisions on behalf of what they think or what they feel or what their motivations are. You have to really understand them through some process. So there's process that goes into discovering who you're ultimately writing your apps for. And if you go through that process, then you'll be more successful in the future with what you end up building. So some not so great UX. This is a freecreditreport.com is a website in the U.S. It's very popular. They advertise on TV and radio. But you can see this is your typical web Ajax experience. You know, Ajax came out, developers ran to it, they use it, but they didn't know how to actually react or respond to certain things like the back button on the browser. So when you hit purchase on a purchase, and it happened to me last night in my hotel room buying internet, it said don't hit the back button. So okay, well, that's great. I know what that means, but non-computer users don't know what that means. So we can't just assume someone is not going to hit the back button because we put it in a long sentence over above some rotating arrow. It doesn't work that way. So we have to take into consideration that we need to go the extra mile to make sure the user experience is better, because this person could get charged several times if they hit the back button and they end up not knowing where they're at. This is another good example of data entry. So there's a lot of patterns around data entry and making data entry correct. The person selected American Express as their credit card. They typed in their number and they hit save, and a validation error came back and it said, well, you picked American Express, but you didn't format the card correctly when you input it. And how often do we run into that? Credit cards are the worst because you never know. I mean, to this day, I never know what format I should type it in. Should I put the spaces in there? Does it want a dash? You never actually know, because the validation rules are inconsistent across all websites and they're not forgiving. So you as a developer know what a credit card number should be. We all know what the patterns are. We all know the checksums of the numbers. So let's figure it out and not make put the burden on the user, because it's making them do something extra when we really do already know the answer. So some really great UX. This one is maybe more popular in the U.S. I don't know about in Europe. How many people here have an iPhone? So, you know, it's getting there. It's, you know, held up as the premier example of great usability. Apple goes through an iterative design process for all of their stuff. V1 of most of their things aren't great. Does anyone remember the iPod in like 2001? It wasn't great. But by the iPod 2006, 2007, that was a great MP3 device, and that's really when it started to take off and Apple started making a lot of money. Same with the iPhone. They went through a really good process to come up with that design, and now it's representative of what a phone should be like, and everyone tries to copy it. Phones naturally, you know, some smartphones don't have this capability, but they have shells now that mimic the iPhone. And everyone probably reads all the rumors, you know, Microsoft coming out with a new phone. And it's probably going to have a really exciting interactive experience as well, because that's what people want to do. They want to have that experience on these small devices. Another great UX is the Wii. The Wii in the U.S., there's actually, you go to stores in the U.S., and there's a sign in front of the stores that's limit 2 Wiis per customer, because people buy so many Wiis. They want one for every TV. They want one for their kids, for themselves. Everyone wants a Wii because it's a great experience. So what happened here is the builders of Wii said, well, you know, let's go watch how people play video games. You know, they watch kids, they watch old people, they watch middle-aged people. They get all this data, they put it together, and they come up with something that ends up being really great. And that's the process they follow to get to this really great user experience. So I showed you two pieces of hardware, essentially. We actually build software here. Some of us might build hardware, and that's really what the core is. So how do I actually get to a good user experience in software? How can you help me understand that? Well, the way that you can do it is by following a process. So at Infragistics, we have a process we follow. We have services, and there's all kinds of UX companies in the world that have a process that help people get to the right answer. Some of those processes are short and sweet. Some of them are very long. I sort of have a condensed version here of 3 steps where you can start thinking about how to get to the right answer when you're building software. And this doesn't matter if it's software for internal use. It's probably more important for internal use because it cuts down on the internal costs. But external, you know, ISV, OEM software, if you do it right, you really don't have a lot of support costs. And really that's the goal, is minimizing that support cost, because that's a huge overhead. So the first thing in a 3-step process here is understanding the information architecture. So discover and establish organizing principles. Out of this process, you come up with deliverables. So this step of the process, you're going to have, based on the type of app you're building, so some of this might not make sense. If it's a rich client app, you don't necessarily have to have a search strategy. You might, but maybe not. Some of the deliverables, navigation maps, glossaries, keywords, tags, categories, search strategies. These are important because the search strategy, for example, could be an implementation piece on how people might get around in information architecture. There's a whole science behind that. But when we think about things like glossaries and terms that we use in categories, when you're building software, that's what everyone on the team who's building it needs to understand and communicate so everyone's talking the same language. A lot of times on projects, when you're building software, someone recognizes something as X and the other person recognizes it as Y. So when you're having meetings and talking about stuff, you might be talking about the same thing, but you're not using the right words. So having a baseline when you're starting to build an application through glossaries and keywords is important. And this follows through to the ultimate application because that's how the end user is going to use it on the web or in the rich client side. So the next step would be interaction design. This is 99% of the time never done. When we build applications, we just start with opening up Visual Studio, creating a form, throwing some controls on there, using a SQL connection, showing it to the boss, and he's like, let's build it. When can we put it in production? It looks done to me. And then you're like, oh, there's all this stuff we got to do. There's all this back-end stuff, because that's what we're concerned about. We're concerned about the infrastructure and the plumbing and not the UI. So oftentimes the UI stays right where it's at, and then most of our work ends up being on the rest of the app. Well, in order to actually have that great user experience from the customer standpoint, you have to follow this interaction design process, which means creating storyboards to understand how the user is going to use every screen in your application. And you actually, and this is actually drawings that were taped to a whiteboard at Infragistics over something we were building, but through this process, you're telling the story of what this person is going to go through every single day when they use the application that you're building, be it a website or be it a rich client app. So there's steps they follow, there's screens they use, and through this process, you start to have discussions and ask questions about every single piece of every single screen, and it helps you refine what ultimately gets built. So if you don't have a good interaction design process and you don't go through this storyboard, wireframe sketching process that you can actually take and show to a user and have them validate and talk to you about it, then you're missing a huge piece of understanding the usability of this application. So the end user, if they're not part of this and if you don't do it, then you're just making decisions on behalf of them. Now, just as easily, you could do this in PowerPoint or Visio and bring it to a desk and show them in PowerPoint and Visio. You don't have to actually draw stuff, but this is a good way to be able to carry it around. At Infragistics, we have like whiteboards with things taped on them, and we just take it to an office and say, hey, what about this scenario? What do you think? Oh, let me go talk to a customer about this and see what they think. So the customer is always part of the conversation when we're building features. And I think it's important that this isn't minimized, even though most of the time, in my experience, people normally don't do this part of it. People normally go right to this last step three here, which is building the user interface. You know, this is that prototype that just magically turns into the delivered application. So, and this last step is when you are thinking about the user interface, the actual pieces of the UI, the patterns that make up the UI, the colors, the themes, all the visuals that ultimately will be used to build out the experience that you're trying to build. So some of the deliverables here are theme styles, palettes, typefaces, mock-ups, images, visual guidelines, and then finally patterns. And the reason I have patterns underlined and in red is because that's really the core of how you can get to doing the right thing. I think that we know about patterns, we talk about patterns, but we don't use them in the context of the user interface. And that's normally what happens here because people aren't used to looking up, you know, let's go do a search for a pattern to help me do navigation. And that's what I'm going to help you get around that today. So let's go into these patterns in user experience. So this is design patterns, elements of reusable object-oriented software. How many people have this book on their desk? Yeah, everyone. So it's common, right? Because we're all developers. How many people here are designers? Wow, okay, so there's like three more than the previous talk I did. So I think there's six in the whole room, maybe seven. And like I said, you guys should be making a lot of money in the next few years with all this exciting stuff. Designers are really becoming to another tier when it comes to the Microsoft products, because they're really necessary now to create these unbelievable user experiences. So a lot of these books that are popping up now are all about patterns, various approaches to patterns for different pieces of software engineering. But what we're going to talk about are interface patterns. So there's two really good books out there right now on user interface patterns. One of them is called Designing Interfaces by Jennifer Tidwell, and the other one is called Designing Web Interfaces by Bill Scott and Teresa Neal. Now, what these books do is they take a bunch of things that people do all the time or have done all the time over years, categorized them, compiled them, and to the best of their ability, created a rationale for why they should be used. And in Fragistics, we took it a step further, and we've created an online experience that helps you explore patterns and add it to actually what they have across these books. So when we talk about patterns, just like anything else, when you're building something, there's the knowing, the understanding, and then the using part. So you have what, why, and how. And if you break apart a user interface pattern into those sections and you start building out content around every possible area of a user interface pattern, then you start to come up with something very rich that will help explain why or why not to use a specific pattern in a certain area. So in this case, the what is iconic visualization. There's also other patterns with this iPhone user interface, but the three things we have in the what would be the name, the problem, and the solution. The when and why are the context for using this pattern and the rationale. And then finally, how it's implemented, and then showing examples of this. So this is sort of a template, and if you start collecting patterns that you use in user interface and looking elsewhere people are using, you come up with a really good library of things that you can refer to for the next project or the next job. And every pattern, what's interesting is it has a similar context and a similar rationale for what you need to do, but the UI doesn't have to be the same. There could be very different user interfaces for the same pattern. And it has to do with the type of data, the amount of data, and really what the goals are of the application. So this example is of Quince, which I'm going to bring up a little bit later. Quince is a Silverlight-based UX Patterns Explorer. And you can see there's a lot of depth to a pattern when you start getting into it, when you start looking at the different examples of patterns and how they can actually be implemented to build a better user interface. So I'm going to quickly go through a few patterns, and then we'll take a look at Quince. So there's some categories to patterns, one of them being finding your way around. So this is a pattern called faceted navigation. Faceted navigation you use a lot if you go to bookstore websites, airplane websites, whatever. But the problem here is that the end user, the person using this website, sort of has an idea of what they want to look for, but they're not quite sure. And you, as the provider of this data, have maybe hundreds or millions of items for that person to look for or filter through. So how can you put this in an easy way that they can start to meaningfully navigate through this data to ultimately find what they want, and your goal is to get them to purchase? So through a faceted navigation where you're breaking things up into categories and facets, people can start clicking through and filtering and filtering and filtering their search very visually so they know where they're at. Another example is for airplane sites, when you do travel sites, when you do searches and you get a bunch of flights back. It's very common that on the left-hand side, there's check boxes based on the type of flight you want: non-stop, one-stop, multi-stop, specific airlines, lowest priced, high priced. And that list on the right keeps getting filtered smaller or larger based on the criteria you select. So from a user perspective, you could easily use a paging pattern and just throw out a bunch of stuff like a Google search or a live search, and they would have to click next, 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 next. Well, that's a horrible user interface because you don't know how, you can't compare anything. So you're trying to do some sort of analysis to come to a decision. It's different than a search, because a search, you're just sort of like wandering around trying to learn and explore. This, you actually want to get to something specific, and so the faceted navigation will help you get there. In Quince, we use this with a filter box on the right based on category, and then across the top, if you happen to know the pattern name, we have the a filter alphabetical list box. So you click L and all the patterns that begin with L show up. This is another good example from a user experience perspective of giving people the data the way they want to search for it, the way they want to look for it, or the way they want to view it. Oftentimes, every application or many applications have one way of getting from point A to point B when all users aren't the same. So if you are building a stock trader app, you're probably pretty sure all users are the same because they're hardcore broker dudes who have like five screens and they have to do things all the same way because it's very fast. You don't want to give them four options. But if you're building a search airline screen or you're building a book site, you want someone who's 75 years old to search their way and someone who's a power user, 14-year-old, to search their way. You don't want to give them one way of searching. So that's just another user experience tip when you're doing things like searching and filtering. Another pattern is clear entry points. So this oftentimes isn't important maybe in a rich client app like Outlook, for example. Outlook pops up. You don't need a clear entry point because all of a sudden you have a two-panel pattern where there's a list of stuff that you want to work with, and then you select that list and things show up on the right-hand side. But let's say we want to do a search. The only reason we go to Google or live.com is primarily to search. So there's a very clear entry point on what the user should do. They don't have to search and look for what the primary goal of going to this site is. So if you do have a very specific primary goal on what the user should be doing, make a very clear entry point for them to get there. If you look at applications like, this is Expression Blend, I believe Visual Studio has something very similar. But this is different in the fact that it has this checkbox here where it says run at startup. So a clear entry point here for a richer application is, okay, we know you've never used Blend because it's a brand new product, and we're pretty sure you don't know what to do first. So we're going to give you a clear entry point, few tasks that you might want to perform, like a new project, new website, get help or get samples. And after you use it a few times and you do become an expert, just uncheck this box and we'll never show it again. So when you do a clear entry point scenario in an application, always be forgiving and let the user uncheck it so the next time they come in, they don't have to go, oh, I hate this dialogue. Like, tip of the day, this is the worst. And honestly, tip of the day should just go away because through all the research, they should realize no one reads tip of the day. I just installed Ipswitch FTP Pro or something like that, and the tip of the day popped up. I'm like, no one reads tip of the day, but they're still there. So good enough, they do have an uncheck box. And then in Quince is a search tool. So the only thing you actually do with Quince is search. So we don't want to have an uncheck box here, like get rid of this clear entry point. But what we do want is give them a simple search box on the top and then four options on how to explore all of the patterns that are in the library. So the idea here is, this is a clear entry point, but it's very specific because this is primarily a search tool. Something like Live, there's a lot more to Live than just search. Live is a very rich environment, rich experience, but the primary goal is search. All right, so Liquid Layout, this is a cool one. I'm going to show you a quick demo of a cool Liquid Layout we're working on. Liquid Layout comes from the concept of the shell of the application or the container looks at its content as liquid. So you pour in a bunch of liquid, what does it do? It consumes the container. So a lot of times applications like list applications, like a list of things, you can resize windows and everything gracefully resizes inside of it. Web applications, on the other hand, are more challenging. Even infragistics.com, it drives me crazy because it's like centered. It doesn't flow with the size of my monitor. So I'm at 1900 by 1200. I go to our website and everything's in the middle, and there's all this space on the side, and it's a smaller font, and it doesn't look right when you do Control plus plus to make it go bigger. So that's not built with a Liquid Layout in mind. Some websites are built. Live News, for example. If you go to live.com and you click News, as you resize, the news columns resize nicely. So no matter what browser you're viewing it in, and no matter what screen size, you can have the same exact experience. Outlook uses a similar style of Liquid Layout. So Outlook, when they build Outlook, they understand that the primary use of Outlook is to view that list of emails, select an email, and see it on the right-hand side. So things like the navigation pane and the to-do bar are sort of superfluous data that people don't need. They're distracting in many cases. So what they added in Outlook 2007 was this flyout. So you can actually click the flyout button right here, and then this pane closes up to the left. And now I can select it, and a little area will pop out and let me still easily navigate to the folders that I want, but it's not taking away from the primary goal, and everything inside of this container is actually being represented correctly. And then Quince does a liquid layout too based on resizing of the screen. Silverlight is a very rich platform, and Silverlight is great for doing liquid layouts because you can do resizing very easily. And since it does vector graphics when it renders, no matter how big or how small it gets, you still have that crystal clear clarity of the font on the screen. So here, let me bring up a quick example. I have an example of a liquid layout, and this is sort of a concept that is built in WPF, but it kind of hits home that in any type of application you can come up, you can take a pattern and use it in a specific way. So this is a reference app we're building, and you can actually get this off of CodePlex. It's called healthcare.codeplex.com. And this is the way that we came up with this liquid layout scenario. This is for emergency room doctors. But you'll notice as I resize, the boxes inside the panels resize with the layout itself. And so whatever's in there, WPF, of course, it does great resizing, helps me do that. The other thing I can do is based on what I want to see, the layout can shift on the primary focus of the screen. So in this case, I want, this is an emergency room doctor. He's talking to the patient. He's like, oh man, Mr. Jones, let me look at your vital signs. So easily, he could see vital signs here, but he needs to see them up front and center. So the layout shifts based on what's the focus for him at that particular point. Also, he can view other elements at the same time, like so, and I can move other areas, etc. You also know, because of the way WPF works and Silverlight works, there's visual clues on where the elements are going. This is really important. As these platforms get richer, you have to take advantage of these UX possibilities like animations. If I didn't do animations, so I can dampen this back down to nothing, so there is no dampening, what ends up happening is you have a similar experience that you would in Windows Forms, where since there is no animation framework, Windows can change and you don't even know it. So there's no visual clue on where things are actually going. So more common when you see subtle animations of things flying in one place or another, or resizing or going somewhere off the page, it's so you visually can remember that it's over there. So next time you need it, you know where to go. So I think it's really important that as the frameworks mature, the way that we develop applications mature to enhance this user experience. So I think this example of liquid layout from a rich client app is something that we normally don't see, but I think we'll be seeing more and more of in the future. Two-panel selector, this is Outlook. We talked about this. What this pattern does is, the tenet of this pattern is basically you have a list of things that you need to work with. And in those things, you want to view the content or the results of those things individually. So you have a list, and the best way to do that is to have one panel that shows the list and one panel that shows the result of that list. And there's multiple implementations of this. You can look at Windows Explorer as a two-panel selector as well. I have a list of folders. I click a folder, and then on the right-hand panel are the results of that folder, which ends up being all my subfolders or files. And in Snagit, which is a really great image snipping tool for the desktop, they kind of do it a little bit different. Over here on the bottom is my list of things, and then as I select images, they show up on the top. Because it's easier for me to scroll images down on the bottom. I can make them really tiny and get the context of what I'm looking at. Then I select it and it shows up in the big screen. It takes up the full width and height of the screen on the top. So this two-panel selector is just another implementation of a pattern. Another great pattern, overview plus detail. I have a couple cool examples on this. This is becoming more and more popular because of visualizations. So data visualization is one of those things where a few years ago it didn't really matter. It's like, oh, throw a pie chart on there and they'll be happy. Well, now there's so many interesting ways of doing data visualization, and there's so many platforms that do it really well, people want more and more data visualization instead of tabular reports. So here is a map. Maps are very rich. There's tons of detail in maps. It's very easy to get lost as to where you're at. Last night, we were in Brussels trying to drive here. We had a TomTom. It was the worst experience I've ever had trying to figure out where I was, because I kept, like, I was used to using, like, an iPhone, like, you know, multi-touch, making it bigger and smaller. all that did was send me to another screen. There was no way for me to get a bearing as to what my experience was or where I was at to find out where I was going to be next. So here in a map scenario like Live Maps or Google Maps, you have the overview so I know where I'm at. To me, Michigan, I grew up there. It's easy. I know everything about Michigan. Europe? I don't know anything about Europe. I have no idea where I'm at. I thought The Hague was like on the other side of Europe. I just don't know. So when I'm looking at a map, I need context, and it's very confusing. So the overview plus detail in this context ends up being extremely useful because visualizations like mapping are becoming more and more common. This is from Photoshop. Here you look, there's a butterfly, but it's part of a bigger picture. So even when you're designing images like this in an image tool, having this overview plus detail helps people understand the context of the bigger picture. That way they can do the right colors. They don't have to keep scrolling or zooming around and panning with the mouse. And then this is sort of a new way of doing overview plus detail, and this is a timeline. So Google Finance made this sort of popular, and what we've done is created sort of what we call a zoom bar. And this is a great example of where data visualizations can actually go with something like an overview plus detail on something as simple as a timeline. So if I bring up this timeline control, let me go down here. Here is a simple timeline. So you can see I have a bunch of stuff, but I can't see it all at once, but I want to have the context of what the length of all this time is and what items are there. So there's dots on the overview on the bottom, and then the detail just shows me what I'm moving over as I scroll. So I can make this as big as I want or as small as I want, and as I scroll, I get the detail in the timeline itself. So this is what Google uses for Google Finance. Live uses it on their stock search, and they're looking at it from stock perspective. So on the top, they're showing a time period of like 3 months. On the bottom, it's the entire 5 years. So as you move the zoom bar back and forth, the detail ends up changing. You can look at the same thing in something like a map control, and it doesn't even have to be Google Maps. So here's an example. You know, as I do something like zoom into an area, so I zoom in here, but I still know the context of where I'm at and my overview on the bottom, and it allows me to move around and get to other places very quickly, which last night, trying to get here, I couldn't do that, and it was very frustrating. It ends up being frustrating for the end user. So I think overview plus detail, we see a lot, but we don't realize it, and then if we didn't have it, we kind of say, wow, we'd really be lost without it. Alternate views, I brought this up just because it's a very popular pattern used in Windows and in Office applications, but oftentimes we don't make the effort to do this in our own applications. So the context of information, even though a shell, a navigation framework or a visual framework that it lives in might be consistent throughout an application, the contents aren't always best displayed in the same way. So showing alternate view for that data helps the user understand it better. Images are a perfect example of this, and Vista started this, and it's followed through with Windows 7, where you, instead of having a list of images, you can do large or extra large, and it actually shows the content instead of just the file name with some default image. So an alternate view in this case is important. Printing alternate views are very important. So in this case, we have a print preview where it gets rid of all the other stuff, and we're just showing what we want to print. And then, of course, in Word, there's multiple views. Many of us only use one view, but enough people used alternate views that Microsoft made it very prominent in the status bar on the bottom that you can actually select views very quickly based on what you're trying to accomplish. And then, of course, this is familiar to all of us if we're doing Silverlight for sure, because without an alternate view, we'd be in big trouble because you have to type the XAML and you have to kind of see what's happening up top. In a few years, we won't need this alternate view. So this alternate view is only, its lifetime will be quite short based on the fact that the tooling is going to get better in the future. So based on where we're at sometimes, an alternate view is required, but down the road, we really don't need it to be successful. All right, so that's some pattern examples. Some other resources for patterns, I'm going to show you guys the two books I mentioned earlier, Designing Interfaces and Web Interfaces, Designing Web Interfaces. I think the Tidwell book, everyone should have that book. It's a really good book. The Quince Patterns Library, which I'm going to show you in a second, has all of those patterns plus more. But if you like reading and you like getting more background and deeper context over what she specifically thinks, it's a really good book to get. And then some websites. Both of these books have companion websites, but also there's other pattern libraries out there for you to really start learning about patterns to help you build better user interfaces. Yahoo is interesting because Yahoo's pattern library also gives you the control to do it. So it's all HTML-based because it's web-based, but you can get the code snippets that you can actually use based on Yahoo's widget library. And you might say, wow, I really like that carousel panel. I wish I could do that myself. Oh, click here to get the widget, and then you have it. So that's pretty cool if you're doing websites. Wheely.com, I met a fella today who is going to introduce me to Mr. Wheely. So he has a really good patterns library, and I think he's from here, right? Is this? Yep, so he's from the Netherlands, and this is a really good site. It's very inspirational. He goes into some very good detail on higher level patterns or patterns that you might think are higher level. He goes into a lot of detail of richer, more complex patterns. There's another site called UI Patterns. This one's cool because it starts out with a screenshot and then it goes into detail. So since we're visual, the way the mind works is very visual. You remember things visually. You don't remember tabular data. They decide to start out with the screenshot and then help you remember what these patterns are when you're building your applications. And then finally, Patterns Hap is a complete collection of screenshots which demonstrate patterns. So the content is the screenshot. And so if you really want to get some context onto how people use some of these patterns, and this is mostly in websites in this case, you can just look at all the screenshots that are available, and they're categorized by pattern. Oh, and then one last one, Fluid. It's an open source project that also has a patterns library with it, and it's aggregated some other patterns into this open source library as well. All right, so let's take a look at Quince. So Quince is Aria UX Patterns Explorer. And the goal of Quince is to help you learn about patterns that you then take to build these better user interfaces. So here, if you go to quince.infragistics.com, this is a Silverlight application. So what it's doing is it's downloading the application. And here's this clear entry point we talked about earlier into the app. So if I select one of these options to go search, I can type in a keyword, I can do all patterns by task, by tag relations. Watch the screen move as I select all patterns. So you notice I had a visual clue that the search went over to the right-hand side, and on the rest of the entry points went over to the left-hand side into this magnetic drawer, which will pop out if I hover over it. So the visual clue let me know that I did. Those are clear entry points. These are the tasks that you can do with this application. But use the visual clue so I know where to go next time. So let's say I don't want to do this list because I don't know what this list means. I can go search by user tasks. And I can say, well, let me look at the data entry patterns. Now if I look at date, time, input range, I can drill into the pattern and start to learn about what this pattern means and what the rationale is for it, what the context is for it, and then ultimately the implementation. Now the way Quince works is across the top we start out with screenshots. You can click on these screenshots to make them bigger, and they give some rationale around them, and then the source for the actual screenshot implementation. So here's another date, time, range input example. So like I said earlier, the problem might be consistent across applications, but the implementation or the visual that you implement might not be. So if you say, oh, well, people have to select two dates, the first thing you might think of is let's do two drop-downs of date time. Well, in this case, they have a date time range input, which is a slider control. So this is from, this is a sliding date picker. I thought it was Marriott. That previous one was Marriott. But if I'm going to stay somewhere for 3 days, why do I have to do two drop-downs? Why not just select it with a range slider and a range slider? So this pattern could be useful to you based on maybe your screen real estate or the type of user that you're targeting. Maybe older people prefer two drop-downs. Maybe younger people prefer the slides. It's up to you on how you actually implement it or who your users are. And here's another one using sort of a zoom bar. to actually get the date range that you want. So I can look at screenshots, and then I can start to read about the pattern. I'll pop it out a little so we can see it in a bigger context. But you can see that for each one of these items you saw on the lists, you get all of this content for it, the rationale, and then the specific implementation details. And then we go into some more details about the examples and the screenshots, and then we source it. So this is a Yahoo design. This was originated in the Yahoo design pattern library, and then we added to it with other patterns, pattern examples, and filled out the context and rationale. So through these patterns, you will start to get the idea or get ideas around how you should implement things in your application. And there's just tons. So here, if I hit close, let's go back to explore. We can explore by tag relations. So this is just another way for people to learn and explore all of these patterns that are available to them. And on the flip side, this is Silverlight too, so it's a cool example of a Silverlight implementation. But you notice here, data entry has a lot of patterns that are linked to it through tagging. So if I zoom in a little bit, I can see that data entry has date entry patterns linked to it, builders and editors, text input, and then grid. Grid's a little bit bigger. And the interesting thing about this control is that the weight and the size of things are just based on the number of items in each pattern and how they're tag relation to each other. So that pattern also is useful as a search tool. So if you have a lot of information and you want to give it to someone in a presentable way, you could do it in a list, you could do it in a page list, you could do a faceted search, or you could do sort of a relationship map. And based on the importance of objects to each other, the weight changes, so things become bigger or smaller. So in this case, it's just another, we always return back to this master list of patterns, no matter how we actually explore, and then we end up drilling back into the same pattern explorer to get the information that we want. So ultimately, using tools like Quince, and there's over 100 and some patterns in Quince, will help you understand how to get to that better user experience, that better user interface. And the nice thing about this is you can subscribe to the RSS feed, so when people update patterns, so since this is a community effort, basically here, if I scroll down actually right here, you can add comments on this pattern. You could say this pattern could be better, or you could sign in and share your own examples, like upload screenshots. So on the liquid layout pattern, what I did last week was we had the liquid layout created. It looked good. So I went to Quince. I knew there was a liquid layout pattern, and I wanted everyone to know that there are other ways to do liquid layout besides the way, besides the examples that we had in Quince. So here's some examples of liquid layout. Microsoft, these probably look familiar. Here's another one. This is used in Skype. Oops. Scroll over. Here's my liquid layout for the Aqua application up on CodePlex. So based on what the user wants, the container gets filled with all of the user controls, all of the panels, or they get reset. So I uploaded this, and that prompted someone else to actually upload the New York Times as a nice liquid layout. So in their news reader, which is written in WPF, I believe, when you resize, it actually resizes the columns appropriately and shows the text in the right format. So it's a nice way of looking at the data without having to do scrolling and all sorts of needless things that you don't have to do, because you know what the content is, and so why make the user go that extra step to do more work to actually read it? All right, so that's Quince, and I highly recommend everyone go look at that, because what happens is when you do that next application, you have a lot of problems that you need to solve, and they've been solved before. How you implement them is up to what you discover through this interactive design process, through the wireframes, through sketching what the users actually want, through talking to users. So on this graph, what I have is the user interface patterns down in the bottom is the singular patterns that we sort of saw in Quince. So some of them are richer patterns, but most of them are for a task. And that's how we build software initially, is we try to understand those tasks that people are trying to accomplish, and then we match it up to controls. And oftentimes the discussions here at the booths and at the coffee tables is, oh, I'm trying to build this application, I need a control that will help me do this. So we always fundamentally look at it that way. It'll be a while, I think, before we start with this, you know, overarching experience that we want to create. We still have to get to the nuts and bolts of the control. And then the controls make up the visual framework. So visual frameworks would be like Microsoft Office, where we have a ribbon, we have a two-pane selector, we have rich status bars. That visual framework is the same in every Office app. So they have maybe some different patterns within the applications, but overall the visual framework is the same. And then ultimately that leads to this exceptional user experience, which is what our goal is, but the way we get there is by learning from the past. So we can invent new things. There's all kinds of new visualizations and interactions being created every day. But you can also go look at what we've done in the past and past mistakes to help us build the better UIs of the future, and patterns and patterns explorers help us do that. So the last part of the talk, we have about 10 minutes left. I want to go through a few slides here, Hall of Fame, Hall of Shame, which probably we could all do every day with websites as we surf the web. And this is fun to do, and it's some of it is stating the obvious. Like, this is low-hanging fruit, right? Easy to pick off. Unbelievable website. This is a real news website, and they're not kidding. I mean, this is a serious website, and advertisers pay to be on this site. It's crazy. So this is the Hall of Shame. Okay, so obviously this is Hall of Fame. I should have live search up here, but that was in my slide deck, so I get the free pass. Google, with its clear entry point, really pioneered the way that these search providers bring up the screens now. And believe it or not, like, Yahoo still doesn't have this as their default. They have this noisy news portal. And maybe that's what they've decided who their market is. But Google and Live Search recognize that people want to go and just search. So this is a Hall of Fame example. Hall of Shame. Sadly, this is from Interior Architect's website. So the easy thing on this Hall of Shame is the upper right-hand corner where it says turn music off. So if you go to this website, you're going to be enjoying their idea of good music. But the second thing is, how do you navigate in this website? What are the waypoints that are going to help me determine how to get to the next page to understand what these people do? Believe it or not, there are these bars on the bottom. So these bars indicate the sections of their website that they want you to navigate to. So this is horrible navigation. They might have thought it looked really clean and slick, and I hope no one here works at Torchia. But at the end of the day, the average user goes to this website, and even the power user, and they're just guessing as to what's next. And that's not what you want your users to do. Hall of Fame, visual voicemail. I don't know if iPod or iPhone invented this, but boy, is this great. I've never used it. I've seen it. My wife has an iPhone. I have a Blackjack smartphone, which I like, but I get jealous every time she can just delete messages without ever listening to them with the touch of a finger. I have to listen, hit seven. When I get back to the U.S. next week, I have 22 messages. I don't want to listen to any of them. Half of them are hang-ups, but it takes me 10 minutes to listen to my messages. With visual voicemail, what I get is the ability to choose what I want to listen to, view who it is, and delete it immediately, or decide to listen to it. So your voicemail experience goes from 10 minutes down to like 2 minutes. This is, believe it or not, a different website. This is not the same website we saw earlier. This is a training company. So this is 5safepoints.com. It's a driving academy in the U.S. And this is their website. And this is serious stuff. This is about getting a Virginia driver's license, getting approved for the DMV, Department of Motor Vehicles. So by law, you have to have this stuff. And so you get suggested websites to go to sign up. And this is one of them. Horrible. This is horrible too, but you know, you see it, Project for Justice, Project Justice for Animals. We all love animals. We all we're fired up, right? We're going to donate. Show me the site so I can go give my money. And this is what they decided to do. This is their homepage. It's like 80 white boxes with different categories of things that they want you to think about or care about. Again, this is an extreme example, but somewhere along the way, someone thought this was acceptable. Through seeing it somewhere else, or not having good tools to build it, or not having something referring them to the right way to do it. Now, this is a Hall of Fame, and this isn't a website or software, but this is a perfect example of a small change that can literally totally affect how we interact with things in the kitchen. So this is the oxo-angled measuring cup. So measuring cups historically are plastic or glass, and all the measurements are on the side. So as you're pouring stuff, you have to hold it up, and you're trying to gauge it, or it's down here, and you're like that, and you're guessing or whatever. It's never right. This guy, you just pour in, and the measurements are on the inside, angled upward towards you. So this little change in how the numbers are registered on this device or on this actual measuring cup changes the way people look at measuring their liquids or baking cookies or whatever. It's actually a pleasure, and it's actually enjoyable because they know it's exactly right every time, because as they're doing their liquid, they can see exactly what those measurements are. There's another example of a tea kettle where the handle is, here's the spigot and here's the handle. So, okay, I just boiled this water, and I'm going to pour it like this, and that steam is just going to come right up here and burn my hand. I mean, this is for sale. You can buy this stuff. So it's amazing how people don't go through that process of understanding how their users will want to use their product. And in the case of measuring cups, there's billions of measuring cups out there, and they're all the same. This is the only one that I've seen like this. Pop-up messages, of course, are horrible. There's a whole undo pattern I recommend everyone look at, because the fact is, 9 times out of 10, people want to do whatever they're doing. You don't have to ask them. But in this case, let's read this. Cannot sign into communication service because your computer clock is not set correctly. To check the computer clock settings, open date time in Windows Control Panel. Great. So it tells me my computer settings are wrong. It shows me where to check them, but what am I checking them against? Like, what is the right time? What am I supposed to change it to? So I can go open this up. It can look right to me based on my watch, and I can close it, and I'll get the same message again. And this is Office Communicator. So bad UI. You know, help the users get to whatever problem resolution there is, or pop up this date-time changer and suggest to them that they make a change that will help them get to the next step. And then this is second from last one I have. This is Siemens. Siemens actually wins awards for the usability of their websites. So if you want to go and get a good example of websites that work, go to Siemens.com. This is w1.siemens.com. And of course, there are organizations all over the world around user experience. A lot of them are here in Europe. And they vote on these things and have contests and have people comment. And Siemens seems to be very successful at winning these awards. So I would recommend you check out Siemens from a usability perspective. And then, and also with Siemens, you know, if you think about usability, they do a lot of medical equipment. There's a lot of bad medical equipment out there, but medical equipment is used by doctors and nurses to save lives. So they have a lot of experience doing that user-centered design process where they really are understanding their consumer when they build the medical equipment out. And then finally, this Oche Prisma Prepare. This is an amazing example of great user experience. This is a tool to help build binders and design documents. What they've done is the exact way that it's going to print is how you input the information in the screen. So underneath here, this is actually a photograph of the end result manual that they built here. And they look exactly the same. Everything is exactly the way it should be. Print preview is like one of those hit and miss sort of things. You know, it sometimes looks how in the printer as it looked on the screen. The word wrapping isn't always the same. The page breaks sometimes aren't always the same. Sometimes pictures get cropped or cut off at the end of pages. So it's always risky to know what it's actually going to look like when you print it. In this case, they went to great lengths, since these people were actually preparing print content, to make sure that what is displayed is what is going to print. So this is a Hall of Fame example of something that, you know, if we could mimic, I know printing is very difficult, we should try to do it. So that's all I have for today. We basically have 5 minutes left. All of these slides will be available online. I recommend everyone go check out quince.infragistics.com for more patterns. And I'll take questions now if anyone has any. All right. Thank you very much, guys.